Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Wednesdays are the day when we talk to women about any number of things that are going on, particular in their lives from their perspective. And today is no different. I am happy to introduce to you today's guest, Anne Lotta Donnan, who is the author of How to Enjoy Life with Bipolar Disorder. Now, it is said that, in fact, there are some 12.3 million people in the United States and as many 60 million people worldwide who experience bipolar disorder. So, Anne, we are very pleased to have you here with us today to talk about your personal experiences with bipolar disorder.
Well, yes, I'm happy to be here.
Now, it is also said, and as I'm sure you know, that half of all patients begin seeing symptoms between the ages of 15 and 25, but in fact, it can occur at any age. So, Anne, I'd like, before we talk about your first experiences, I'd like you to kind of introduce us to little Anne, that little girl growing up in that family, really having, it sounds like, a grand time with siblings and parents. Where were you born and what was your early life like?
Well, I was born in Boston, and we came out to California when I was five, live in Pacific Palisades, which is where I grew up. It's at the beach. It's really, really beautiful. I went to school with a group of exceptional kids. We had a wonderful time growing up. I just had the most ideal childhood. My parents had three boys before they had me, and my mother had the name Anne Melinda picked out when she was 6 years old, and she always dreamed of having a girl named Anne Melinda. Well, she had the three boys first, and so when I was born, she thought, well, this better be my Anne Melinda, and I didn't disappoint her.
Well, that's a good thing. And so you were the youngest and the only girl.
Yes.
You might have enjoyed preferred status in the household, did you?
Oh, I'm telling you, I was Shirley Temple. I got on my little outfit and danced for the guests. And when we went to Hawaii, I got a muumuu and did the hula. And, you know, I sang at the piano. And I just was the entertainment and could do no wrong.
Well, that sounds like not a bad way to enter into life.
Oh, it was wonderful. My parents were absolutely the best parents in the world. They were both physicians, so they knew when something's wrong, they knew I needed to get to a doctor, and they took me to many doctors before it was diagnosed.
Well, let's talk about, because you weren't diagnosed for several years, even though you began to have experiences with mood swings. When do you remember the first mood swing or the first sort of experience that pulled you up a little bit short, that surprised you?
Well, it was when I started seventh grade. I was 12, and we come back from a year and a half living in Europe. We lived in Paris. And my parents traveled all around doing medical meetings, all the capitals of Europe. So I had a most wonderful year, just absolutely fabulous. We came back, and the devastating paroxysm of manic depression or bipolar disorder hit me like a sledgehammer when I was 12 years old. And starting seventh grade seemed to key it up. You know, I was running around, joining all activities, sports and things, and talking 100 miles an hour and just a real manic phase, and it was not diagnosed. And then by the end of seventh grade, I was depressed, and I had to drop out of school because I slept 15 hours a day, and I had to go to summer school to make up all my grades. In fact, I went to summer school every summer throughout junior high and high school, and even in college.
And that is how you made up your grades.
Yes, yes, I did. I did very well. I ended up majoring in architecture, went through college, got a degree in Bachelor of Science in architecture, and I worked for four different architects in my 20s, and then I had my two children, and then I wanted to have the same hours they did, so I got a teaching credential. I taught drafting for 25 years.
Wow. So before the age of 12, again, it just sounds like almost a fairy tale storybook life. And it was wonderful. No particular stressors that you can identify. It was just a wonderful time. And then come 12 years old, the world began to unravel a bit. Now, I've been saying bipolar, and yes, there was a time when bipolar was referred to as manic disorder. But for those folks who don't know what bipolar disorder is, can you describe what it is and how it affected you?
Well, yes. First of all, I could give you the symptoms, which are being speeded up, unable to sleep. I had almost complete insomnia. I would sleep maybe an hour, and I watched the Johnny Carson show every night just because I wanted to have a little fun. And
that's kind of late night TV, though.
Yeah. And I laughed. I mean, I just had to laugh. And I was so speeded up. It sounded like I was taking amphetamines. And I did not have any hallucinations in the early years. I had hallucinations later. But mostly I talked so much that I didn't let the other person talk. And I didn't care what they had to say. I just talked and talked and talked. And then I went to the next person and talked and talked and talked. It's like I didn't care what they had to say. I just needed to talk. It's like words just came pushing out of me. And I developed what's called pressure of speech, where my thoughts were going faster than my speech. And I was extremely frustrated that I couldn't get out the words fast enough.
So, in fact, it sounds like your speech was almost on, you know, you were almost a speed demon on a roller coaster. Words
exactly,
were just flying
exactly.
out of
and
your
roller
mouth.
Roller coaster is a good analogy because I couldn't stop it and I couldn't get off.
Now, again, it's now called bipolar disorder. There was a time when it was manic depressive. So you're telling us about the what would have been at one point considered the manic phase. When you say you right. were speeded up, in addition to your speech, were there other things that were speeded up for you during those phases?
Well, yes, my movements. I was in constant motion, running from person to person. In the neighborhood, I went running up and down the street. I jogged. My father jogged every morning before work, and I went jogging with him. And then I went swimming. All this before school, I swam probably 40, 50 laps. And then I went to school and was extremely speeded up at school. And my mother knew something was wrong, my father also, but they didn't know what it was. They thought it was maybe teenage hormonal imbalance. And so they took me to a psychiatrist. When it went on for 3 months, they took me to a psychiatrist, and he didn't know. They didn't know much about it in those days. Hmm. And so when I came down on the tranquilizers, they didn't understand that I was going into a deep depression. I just slept 15 hours a day, and all they could do was let me sleep. I just couldn't be aroused, couldn't be awoken. So this depression, now the big difference between mania and depression is mania, you bother everybody. You're going crazy. It's like a bomb going off, and they have to pick up the pieces. With depression, you don't bother anybody. You just sleep all the time. And my parents, again, thought it was teenage hormonal imbalance, and they just let me sleep. And like I said, I had to drop out of school and take the classes in summer school.
But, you know, those were pretty extreme experiences, that you were sleeping so much that you actually had to drop out of school because you couldn't
yes.
get to class.
I couldn't get dressed. I couldn't put my clothes on. I was like a catatonic almost. I just sat, and then for the short time I was awake, I remember sitting in the living room and just looking out the window. And my parents were afraid at that point that I was becoming catatonic, you know, but it was just a deep depression, deep clinical depression. Now, I might add here that there's a difference between reactive depression, which is and you react to, say, a death of a loved one or losing your job or losing your house or your teenager acting up. You react to a lot of circumstances and you get better when the circumstances get better, or you get over the grief, you go back to normal life. With a clinical depression, there's nothing that makes it better except medicine.
Okay.
And it's not a response to your life. I had a very happy life. You know, no reason to be depressed. And also, if you had asked me if I was depressed, I would have said no. I just felt horrible. I didn't know it was depression. I didn't feel sad. I just felt awful and no energy to do anything.
And, you know, I think you've made a very important point, which is if you're aware that you're, whatever word you put on it, you're feeling sad, you're feeling down in the dumps, you're feeling blue, and it's going on for a period of time, and you can't point to why that might be the case, then there's absolutely, that's a time to get an evaluation to see if someone else can help you figure out what might be going on. As you were going through these phases, from the mania to the depression, do you recall being aware that there was something different that was happening with you?
No, and that's interesting too, because I lived in the moment so much that I was unable to evaluate the past, evaluate the present, look forward to the future. I just lived in the moment. You know, and I was so tired with the depression, that's all I could think of. Just one thought, let me go to sleep. You know, and when I was awake, I ate a lot. Another interesting thing, I ate a lot and then hibernated like a bear. That's what I called it. And I ate tons of food and gained a lot of weight. And then when I was manic, I would lose a tremendous amount of weight. I didn't eat at all. You know, my stomach felt full and euphoric. My whole body was euphoric. And I just wasn't hungry. I didn't eat anything. And so my weight would fluctuate great. I'm normal weight. I'm basically normal weight. But it would go up 30 pounds and then down 30 pounds below normal weight. So I was like a walking skeleton.
Interesting. When you were experiencing the pressured speech, were you aware that your speech was coming out very rapidly?
I was only aware that it wasn't coming out rapidly enough.
Uh-huh.
I had pressure of speech because I had so much to say. I pushed it out, but it wasn't coming out the way I wanted. And it was extremely important to me to get it out. And then I was just frustrated that I couldn't get it out as fast as I wanted. And it was extremely important to me that the other person understand what I was saying.
So between the ages of 12 and 19, even after a stay first in the medical part of the hospital and then in a psychiatric area, you still had not been diagnosed as
right,
experiencing.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, I was in the hospital three times. The third, well, four times, because once as an adult I was in the hospital. But three times as a teenager, I was 17, 18, and 19. And again, I was living in the moment, so I couldn't evaluate the past or the, you know, it's so all-consuming. All you can think about is what you're going through now. You can't really think about the past or the future. But I remember the first two times, they put me on large doses of Melaril, which, if you're familiar with that, I was taking 1,600 milligrams a day, which is huge. I mean, 400 is a large dose. And that's what it took to bring me down from the manic episode. And then I had group therapy and talking to a doctor. And, you know, we talked a lot about my past and what was going on in the present. And again, we couldn't find any reason that would really make me that way.
But clearly you were struggling. And
oh, yes.
How frightening it must have been for your parents, even as physicians, they knew something was up, but they just couldn't figure out what it was.
Exactly. And they were wonderful. Like I said, they got me to the doctors right away. First of all, I had a physical exam, a complete physical. Then a psychiatrist. I was seeing, this was at UCLA. My parents were doctors at UCLA at this time. And they had me see the head of the Neuropsychiatric Institute there, who was a wonderful doctor named Dr. Tallman. He was head of the institute for a long time. And he was the first doctor to see me. And even he didn't diagnose it because, like I said, they didn't know much about it. and I would just appear different at times, and they chalked it all up to teenage hormone imbalance.
You know, unfortunately, the myth still exists now as then, that if you look a certain way, if you're living a certain lifestyle, you know, if you're in a certain social or economic experience, you must be fine. And this is just something, this is some anomaly, but there's nothing really serious going on.
Right. And then the fact that after, you know, I had the mania first, then the depression, then I was normal for summer school. You know, I was completely normal. So every year we thought, oh, gee, that's in the past. It's all normal, until school started again. And then I got all speeded up because I was running around doing everything. You know, I just got so speeded up.
What were holidays like for you in both of these phases, birthdays, Christmases, family holidays? What were they like for you?
Well, they were different whether they were manic or depressed. If it was manic, you know, I'd rip open my presents really fast, eat really fast, talk to everybody really fast, just speed it up. And I was always happy to see my whole family, my cousins and all that. So it was a joyful event, but I had all this pressure to get out my words and talk to everybody. And they noticed that I was, well, manic, but they didn't know what to call it, but speed it up. And the depression, I couldn't talk at all. I'd show up, I had a dress on, and wish my mother practically had to dress me, and I'd go to a wedding or whatever, and I'd just sit there like a rock and stare out of space, you know, like a catatonic.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciate about your coming on today and talking to us is that, you know, so often people hear about a diagnosis that someone has or had, and because they're not necessarily living in it themselves, they don't really understand what it can feel like, not only for the individual with the diagnosis, but for those around who are struggling to figure out what to do next as well. And clearly what you're giving us is a picture that makes sense, that your entire household would be struggling with what's going on, what can we do, what can we not do, what is this?
Right, right.
How did your siblings respond to the changes in mood?
My two oldest brothers were very talkative also. One became a judge and one became a biochemist. And they were extremely talkative at the dinner table. The three of us just talked nonstop. And my third brother, Gil, was just kind of quiet. He didn't talk at all. And as he grew up, I think my parents thought he was depressed. Well, and for his whole life. But he refuses to take any medicine. So there's nothing you can do if the person refuses medical help.
Well, and, that's true.
He could be leading a wonderful life if he was on an antidepressant.
But that's not the path he's chosen.
Right, right. And it's related. You know, depression and manic depression are related.
Of course.
There is a hereditary component, because we believe that my mother was bipolar as well.
Okay. And we're going to take a break, but when we come back, folks, we will continue with Ann Latta Donnan and continue the conversation and the look at her book, which is about her life, and it is entitled How to Enjoy Life with Bipolar Disorder. Your tow truck is waiting. Be right back and ask her what that means. Don't go away, folks. And I am looking at a copy of your book as we speak, and I see a castle in the background, and I see a lovely pumpkin coach in the foreground. Tell us about the subtitle, Your Tow Truck is Waiting.
Well, the tow truck is your Cinderella coach. A pumpkin is supposed to be the coach that Cinderella went to the dance, and if she didn't make it back by midnight, her coach turned into a pumpkin. And I felt that the tow truck meant that I needed a lot of help. You know, I needed help doing this, and I needed to get on the tow truck and do what I was supposed to do. In this case, it was a pumpkin, and it ended up being very beautiful and very joyful. And the coach is leading toward the castle, which doesn't every princess live in a castle?
Absolutely.
So, yes, absolutely, yes. So, and there's a story in the book about how I got the subtitle, but maybe I shouldn't tell it unless you think I should.
Why don't you share just a bit of it?
Okay, well, I was going to my therapy one time, and I had surgery on my left foot, so on my right foot. So I was driving with my left foot, and my right foot was hanging on the seat, and I pulled into the parking space, and I wanted to move about a few inches further just to get all the way in, and my foot slipped and hit the pedal hard, and I went through a block wall. And so I went into my therapy anyway. I thought it's going to take them an hour to get the tow truck here. So I went into the therapy, and I was laughing with the therapist, saying, "Oh, I drove through a wall. Can you believe it?" And she was laughing too. And I came out, and there was a waiting room full of people, and the receptionist said in a pretty loud voice, "Your tow truck is waiting." And that was let everybody know that I was the idiot who drove through the wall, because, of course, everybody's standing around staring at it like a bunch of gossips and vultures, you know, staring at my tow truck. And they had just gotten it out. So your tow truck is waiting, just, you know, highlights an embarrassing situation.
Absolutely. And I can almost see, you know, the receptionist sort of making this grand announcement and you wanting to disappear.
Yes, exactly. The embarrassment. Yes.
All right. Let's talk about the experience for several years of having these mood swings, as you describe, where you would be completely down in the dumps, almost immobile, then you were in a speeded up place. And what, I mean, this went on until you were about 19 years old. So that's a long time to go through these mood swings and have no idea as to what was really happening with you. Were you frightened?
Oh, terribly. It was just a living hell to go through junior high and high school, which is hard for any teenager. But to be, you know, at one point I was class clown. I was very funny. I had all my friends from elementary school, the same 40 kids went through school together. And that was my support group. They all knew me so well that they liked me. They loved me. And I got support from all of them. But I went to a private girls' school through 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and part of 11th grade to the private girls' school. And I even boarded there. My mom was in the Mayo Clinic. She had three very serious back operations. And I just didn't want to be at home alone with my father and my three brothers because I was cooking dinner every night, and it just got to be too much. So I said, I want to board at the boarding school. And they said, fine. So I did that.
And was this Westlake?
Yes. And it's now called Harvard Westlake. They joined with the boys' school, Harvard, and the girls' school is Westlake, so they joined in their co-ed.
You talk about, though, when you were there, sometimes when you had some really painful experiences. You thought the FBI and the CIA were watching you through the television. You thought your bed was on fire. I mean, it was really hard.
Yeah, that was paranoid. I was paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And for those who've not ever been in that experience, can you describe a little more what paranoia felt like for you?
Well, it's an extreme fear that doesn't let up. You know, some things you're afraid for a few moments and then you feel better. Like someone's walking toward you at night and you're really scared, and then they walk right on past and you feel relief. Well, with paranoia, you don't have any relief. You are just scared all the time. You just, and paranoid that I really thought that I was so interesting that the FBI and CIA would be watching me through my television. And it made me very afraid just all the time, you know?
And you know, one of the ways that I've tried to describe the experience of paranoia for some folks is that there's literally no safe place.
Right. Right. When you're alone, you're still afraid. Right. Yes.
But there's no place you can go. There's no place you can be. There's no one you can talk to that you have the experience of being safe and supported.
Right. And this caused me to become more catatonic. You know, I was just so afraid. I was paralyzed with fear. And I tell about in the book, there's a short story by Conrad Aiken called Silent Snow, Secret Snow. And it's about a little boy. He's on a warm, sunny day. He's at school, and he's looking out the window, and he sees snow. But it's not really snowing. He just sees it, and he's mesmerized by it. So he stares at it and stares at it. And then it goes day by day by day. The snow gets deeper and deeper, and he discusses trudging through the snow and the mailman coming. The mailman, he can hear the footsteps more and more lightly as the snow gets deeper and deeper. And what it is the little boy finally becomes consumed in this world of snow, and he descends into catatonic state and presumably death, because when you're truly catatonic, you won't eat.
So it has all the potential for being an incredibly scary experience on the inside and the outside for the individual.
Oh, yes.
And everyone
around
them. And like
I say, horrible on my parents. And, they did the best they could to help me.
You kind of went into a tailspin after the breakup with a college boyfriend. Tell us about that.
Well, his name was Mike, and I met him at a dance my first week there. I was 17 years old, and we started going out. We went on dates like Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We went on dates, and then all during the week we'd talk on the phone 5 times a day, and we'd probably meet a couple times, and we talked a lot, and you know, we were very much the campus couple. Then he stopped seeing me without a reason why. He just stopped calling. And I started weeping. And my mother took me up Northern California to a wedding. And I remember just crying all night, you know, and she was sleeping. And I just tried to, you know, be quiet. But I was just in tears and weeping and weeping and weeping. And then this curious thought came to me. I didn't really care that much about Mike. I didn't call him. I didn't try to find out why. I just let it go. And so he didn't really mean that much to me, so why was I weeping? You know, and that was the first depression where I was manic up until then and went into a depression after that. But it wasn't really about Mike. It's just that the situation with Mike triggered it.
So he was really just a symbol for you. It wasn't about him at all.
Right, right. He was my boyfriend, and, you know, I felt very sad. But like I said, when I evaluated it, I thought, you know, that's not what's making me so upset.
Yeah, yeah. There was a time when you were actually finally diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through those moments and what that felt like for you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the first 3 times I was hospitalized, age 17, 18, 19, I saw the same doctor each time. And he thought, like everyone else, that I had teenage hormonal problems. And they put me on this huge dose of Melaril, which finally brought me down. And then, like I said, the situation of a manic episode and a depressive episode lasts a certain amount of time from person to person. For me, it was about 3 months manic, 3 months depressed. And then, thank the Lord, I had a wonderful time in the summer. I felt very good and did well in school and, you know, was very, very happy. And then it happened again and again and again and again and, you know, 7 times. And so finally, the last time, he put me in the hospital for a long period. I was in for a total of 9 months. I think of it as time to have a baby. Anyway, he he saw my mood swings up and down, and he had me on a lot of medicine. And then he just came into me one day and he said, "Ann, I think I know what's wrong with you." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I think you're manic depressive." And I thought, "Oh, thank goodness, they found out what's wrong." That's my first thought. Not, "Oh, what a terrible illness," but just, "Oh, thank goodness, they know what's wrong. Now they can give me the correct medicine and I have a chance for a healthy, wonderful life," which is pretty much what happened.
Well, and as you say that you were in the hospital for almost 9 months, I mean, in today's world, you can barely be in the hospital for 9 days unless you're truly at death's door.
Well, this was a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah. So it was very different.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So you now had a diagnosis. And what did the doctor say to you about treatment?
He just said, "We're going to try you on lithium," which is the medicine. And I had to take thyroid because lithium wipes out your thyroid. And so I just took 1,500 milligrams of lithium every day, which is a very large dose because I had such a severe case of it. He put me on a large dose of lithium, and I stabled out. And then the last 2 months I was in the hospital, I was working. I was an overseas radio operator. So I left the hospital every day, went to work, and then came back and had dinner and spent the night in the hospital just to sort of transition me into the regular world.
And, you know, I think in so many ways that makes such sense that you would have that opportunity to transition. I wish there were more opportunities for that even as we speak. How did your family react to, and your siblings in particular, how did they react upon hearing what your diagnosis was and what your treatment would be?
Well, let's see, they were all different. Bill, the oldest, was just pretty angry with me because, like I said before, I was Shirley Temple and I could dance and sing and do the hula and, you know, I got all the attention and, you know, Bill was pretty jealous. John, we always called him Saint John because he never did anything wrong and he always would volunteer to do the dishes or rake the leaves or, you know, he'd come home from school and go, "Mom, is there any chores you'd like me to do?" And we used to say, "Cut it out, John. You're making us look bad."
And he was.
he was always volunteering. But and then if one of us did something wrong and they couldn't figure out who it was, my dad would punish all of us. So John would take the blame just to save the rest of us, even if he didn't do it.
Definitely Saint John.
So he was my Lord and Savior. He was just, well, not literally, but he was an angel watching over me. And Gil was just so quiet. Again, we think he was depressed and still is, but he didn't talk at all, so I didn't have any reaction from him.
That's interesting because, you know, there are times in family situations where if there's one child, as you know, if there's one child who's getting a lot of attention, even if it's attention as a result of a negative, then the other child or children, they just tend not to be happy campers about that.
No, they were fine. First of all, Bill and John were studying really hard. You know, they became a judge and a biochemist. They came home and did their homework every day. They worked really, really hard, and they became very successful. Gil had a hard time with school, so my dad sent him to the Army-Navy Academy in Carlsbad, you know, where he had to wear a uniform and march 4 miles every day before breakfast, which he hated.
I wonder why.
Yeah. I'd say the worst reactions were my parents. They were suffering right along with me, and they kept telling me they loved me, and they said they knew something was wrong. They didn't know what it was, but I wasn't normal, you know, and they knew that, and they were hoping, like I would, that there would be a correct diagnosis. And by this time, of course, they knew it was mental illness. They just didn't know what.
And I believe you said that your mom may have had bipolar disorder?
Bipolar, yes.
Okay, all right. And was there anyone else in your family as far as you know?
Well, very sadly, my daughter.
Ah. And how old is your daughter?
37.
All right. So, again, it speaks to the comment that you made earlier about the fact that this can run in families. If a family member has it, doesn't guarantee that you will, but it certainly paves the way, if you will, for a similar experience.
Yes. And interestingly, my daughter came down with it when she had her first baby. It's called postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
Postpartum bipolar disorder. And it's just being discovered now. I have another friend who had it. It started same exact thing. Her name's Diane Harwood, and she has a Facebook page and all the things that I'm doing, she's doing for women who have a baby and then come, you know, they have the postnatal depression is somewhat common, but postnatal bipolar disorder is a new diagnosis.
And the more that people who have these experiences come out in the public as you are, whether it's writing or talking or whatever it is, to let folks know the reality of what these experiences are, absolutely the more helpful it is to everyone.
Right, right. That's why I wrote the book. And it's available at Amazon for $3.99, and the paperback goes from $11 to $15 if you look for it online, and it's available at any bookstore where they're sold. You know, you can order it. Anyway, I'm going to have book signings coming up. I'm just doing a lot of interviews now, and then we'll do the book signings.
You described it. I'd like to go back to your experience with the lithium. You took the lithium, and it worked well for you.
Yes, it worked well in that it stabilized my moods, but it was terrible in that it made me sluggish. I felt like I was walking through mud. It was just the most oppressive feeling. It was just awful. But it kept me out of the hospital. You know, I did not cycle manic or depressed, but I just went through 20 years of feeling very, you know, like you wake up in the morning and you're supposed to feel good, like after a restful sleep. I felt just like, oh, so hard to get out of bed, so hard to get dressed, so hard to eat breakfast, so hard to go to work. And then all that pressure of when things are so bad all the time and so difficult, then you become very depressed. So that was a reactive depression. That wasn't part of the manic depression.
Mm-hmm.
But I was depressed, too, with my children. I couldn't enjoy them as much as I wanted to.
There was a time when, even though the lithium was working for you, you were in the care of a doctor who thought that you should be off the lithium.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that was the worst mistake of my whole life. This doctor, well, he's passed away right now, but anyway, he was such a bad doctor, and he took me off all medicine, everything. He took me off everything, and he said, let's see how you do, like it was an experiment, you know. And I got very depressed. Well, I was fine for about 2 months because the lithium was in my system for about 2 months. Then I started to get severely depressed. And I called him every week and said, please put me on medicine. Please, I need it. I need it. And he kept saying, oh, wait a few weeks. Wait a few weeks. You'll feel better. You'll feel better. Well, I waited 3 months, and then I went manic. And I was manic for 2 months, and he still wouldn't put me on medicine. And I ended up in the hospital then. Now, that's when my children were 10 and 12, and I was married, and it was really hard on that family. You know, they went through what my parents went through.
Of course.
And, of course, a little child doesn't understand it, you know. So it was really horrendous, and it was all because that doctor, not only did he take me off drugs, but he refused to put me back on them when I was begging him. And I wasn't smart enough. When you're in this state, again, you're thinking in the moment. It didn't occur to me that I could go to another doctor, you know, just leave him and go to another doctor. Just didn't occur to me as possible. But of course it's possible.
But again, so many people just don't think that way and may find themselves spending years with doctors that they really feel uncomfortable with. And
right.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue with How to Enjoy Life with Bipolar Disorder by Ann Lotta Donnan. We'll be right back, folks. We'll be right back. you talked about two different experiences, one in which you were well-diagnosed, took medication, and it worked well. Another time that another physician took you off all medication and it just didn't work at all. And you also talked about a sibling who you believe could benefit from medication and just won't take it. So the conversation about medication, what would you like for people who are listening to think about when it comes to psychotropic medications?
Okay. First of all, they will tell you it takes 6 weeks to work. And in my case, it took 2 months. I don't know why, but I'm just different. But so I tell them, stay on it for 2 months. A lot of people go on it for 3 days, and you may have a few symptoms in those 3 days. You may feel a little anxious or out of sorts, or just, you know, you just feel funny for 3 days. That's when a lot of people quit taking it. They go, oh, I tried it. It was horrible. I'm not taking it again. Well, it really works if you give it a chance. And like I say, 6 weeks for maybe most people, in my case, 2 months, and then it kicks in. And when I started taking antidepressants, I was so thrilled. I take Wellbutrin and Zoloft, a combination, and it works wonderfully well. I haven't been depressed for a moment. Now, I've had upsetting circumstances, and I have, you know, a life like everybody else where bad things happen, sad things happen, but I have not been depressed 1 second. And I've not been really manic, but I do get, like I'm right now, I'm talking fast, and, you know, I do get speeded up, but nothing like a real manic episode.
Sure. Would you say that you're feeling anxious right now?
Not anxious, just I want to get out as much as I can.
Well, I have to tell you that you're really doing a good job of painting a picture that lets the listener know what it was really like for you, the ups and the downs, and how you sort of walked through your life.
Right.
What's happening?
And I would like to say that there is hope out there. There is good medicine, and there are good doctors. Unfortunately, there are bad doctors, and there's bad medicine. And some people get, like I did, I felt stuck with this doctor. I didn't understand that I could change doctors, and that's always an option. If you feel this person is not helping you, and I describe this in the book, that you need a personality match with your doctor. You have to feel comfortable around him. You're going to bear the secrets of your soul to someone. You'd better like them and trust them. And, you know, if you feel he's some scary figure or some super medical man, or, you know, there's a whole lot of negative things in there that you could feel, then you need another doctor. And the hope, the medicine is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And they've improved it since the year 2000. You know, I really have no side effects from the medicine.
So for you, it really is working well.
Oh, perfectly, yes.
Let me ask you about your daughter, if you're willing to talk about her.
Yeah, we're just not going to say her name.
That's fine. When was she diagnosed?
Well, she had her first baby. That was the beginning of the hormone problems. And then she had her second baby 2.5 years later. And it just got worse and worse.
Mm.
And she saw a lot of doctors. The same thing they did to me. They put her on tranquilizers and this and that, you know, to try different medicine. But she hasn't done well until the last 3 years. She moved to Denver, which she loves, and she loves being outdoors. She loves to ride horses, and she's in marathon mini marathons, you know, the 10-mile races.
Good for her.
And her two little boys are 5 and 7 now, so she's doing very, very well, and she's on a lot of medicine, but it works for her.
Good.
You know, and she takes it exactly as she's told to, you know, so she's doing extremely well.
That's really wonderful to hear. And again, you know, a lot of times certainly with bipolar disorder, there are folks who, you know, when they're feeling better, when they're feeling manic, so let me say when they're feeling differently, they don't really want to take the medication. Did you ever have those experiences?
Yeah, but I didn't relate it to the medicine. I just remember, well, let me describe the mania a little bit.
Okay.
When I got into it, by the time I was in college, it's like it got worse every year from 12 to 19, 7 years. Each year it got worse and worse and worse. And like I say, I was hospitalized 3 times before they correctly diagnosed it and got me on the correct medication. But I wanted to describe the hallucinations, which were very interesting. I would walk down the street and I would move my arms like I was doing the breaststroke swimming. And I honestly thought that I was floating 6 inches above the ground, that my feet were not touching the ground. And I was walking really fast. And if you can imagine how weird that looks, of a woman walking down the street waving her arms like she's swimming the breaststroke, you know. But it felt very good. It was euphoric. And then I painted my dorm room magenta, purple, and my clothing, I wore chartreuse and purple. You can guess purple is my favorite color. Purple and orange, and I didn't think that was at all weird. And I wore all this gold jewelry, and I wore a great big green floppy hat that covered my face. This was in the hippie era. And, you know, I looked like a ridiculous person. Just take one look at me, you go, what's wrong with that person? But especially these hallucinations that I was a fairy. That's what I thought. I was a little fairy coming to Earth to sprinkle stardust on everybody, and I was going to make the whole world cheerful and all these weird things. And I was never hostile. Now, some people get hostile with this. They're so upset, they get very hostile. And with men, unfortunately, having testosterone, they can beat people up or slam their fist in a wall or things like that. But women don't have the testosterone, so they tend to more hallucinate. And, you know, women get hostile too, but it's more like they get hostile verbally.
Okay. What is your life like today?
Excellent. It's just wonderful. I'm happily married. We're retired. My husband and I travel a lot. We're going to see my daughter next month. And we visit a lot of relatives and we're going camping next, hotel camping, because I like to take a hot shower every day. So anyway, we're going hotel camping. Everybody else will be in the campground and we'll have breakfast in the hotel. And then we'll go down and sit on our camp stools and visit people. So we have a really good time. We went to Washington, D.C. My father's was interred at Arlington National Cemetery. He was in World War II. He was a doctor during the war. And a captain, so he got an honor funeral, and that was the biggest honor of my whole life. It was so fantastic. My husband and I went, and oh my gosh, they had 50 soldiers there. They had the 7-gun salute. They had the caisson with 6 horses, and then the riderless horse to symbolize a fallen hero. They played music. They gave the whole funeral service, and they folded the flag and gave it to me, and it was just amazing. And the 50 soldiers, at least 50, I couldn't count. There were so many.
What a huge honor.
But it was at Arlington, and it was just so beautiful. And then we put the ashes into the columbarium where they're going to stay. Then when I die, I can be buried there with him.
It sounds like such a huge honor to have been able to be a part of that ceremony.
Right. Like a lot of people say, you know, I only wish he could have been there to see it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There have been times when your life, like everyone's life, has had ebbs and flows. You've gone up and down. Mm-hmm. Do you believe or have you had the experience of feeling particularly vulnerable at either end of the spectrum because of the bipolar disorder? Or do you believe you do? Okay. So are there things that you do to sort of fortify yourself when you are dealing with something that you know is difficult?
Well, first of all, it's vital to have good health. I eat a healthy diet. I exercise. I try to sleep as much as I can. With the manic, you know, I get a little bit manic. The drugs stabilize you, but they don't cure the illness. I'd say they work about 85%.
Okay.
And the other 15% is up to me to eat well, sleep well, monitor my moods. Now, my husband's very good at telling me, Anne, you've been talking for 20 minutes straight without taking a breath. So I do need to hear that sometimes because I'm not aware of it.
Let me ask you this. You were speaking of your husband, and of course you have a daughter and a son. So, you know, you've certainly got lots of family and relatives around. When you begin dating with a diagnosis like this, do you tell the person or do you not?
Oh, yeah. Maybe on the first date, but as you're getting to know each other, you talk about your children and your families and maybe what you've been through, and that's when it would come up. This is what I went through as a teenager, and, you know, that I've been stabilized except for that one time when the bad doctor took me off medicine, but I've been pretty much stabilized. But my husband does see my moods, and he knows, of course, when I sleep 15 hours a day that I'm going through a depression. But since I'm taking antidepressants, I don't feel at all depressed. I feel wonderful. The antidepressants, Wellbutrin and Zoloft, really, really work. So anyway, in answer to your question, what I do is stay very, very healthy, you know, by exercising, eating right, trying to sleep as much as I can, and monitoring my moods so that I don't become too much manic or depressed.
So, again, what I'm hearing is in the dating arena, you're not going to say, hello, here's my diagnosis. But
no.
When it seems like it is moving along, you
right.
would disclose what your history has been, whatever that history has been.
Right. And they can see that you now, as if they've known you, say, 5 or 6 dates or whatever, they know that you're normal now. They can see that you're normal. They can tell that you're normal. And then you can say, well, this is what I've been through.
Is there ever a time, in your view, when, assuming that you've been together for a while, when it would be okay to keep your diagnosis to yourself?
Oh, as a teacher.
Okay.
Let me put it this way. The words potentially psychotic do not go over well with the school board, the parents, the administration. No, 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 no.
Okay.
They didn't know anything about it till after I retired, and then I told them.
Okay.
Because I wrote the book, and everybody knows I wrote the book.
What was their reaction after they read the book, given that you had never told them?
Oh, it was fantastic, really fantastic. They say things like they started to read it to put themselves to sleep, and they ended up staying up to read it. You know, it's only, I think, 125 pages or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a long book, but they say it pulls you in with the first paragraph. You're so pulled in, and you just want to keep reading and reading. You can't put it down. It really tells the life of a girl going through a tremendous struggle, and then all the help that I got, the support of my parents, and then my friends. You know that old expression, you know who your friends are when you're in a time of terrible trouble. And my friends knew, and I had a lot of help.
When you say you have a lot of help, what does that mean?
Nowadays or then?
Nowadays.
Well, my husband, of course, is the first person. Like I say, he knows when I'm sleeping or not sleeping. Like sometimes he'll go to bed, and I'll try to go to sleep. I'll go to bed, and I'll lie down, and I can't sleep, so I get up and read a book, and pretty soon I'm up all night.
So he's a first line of defense. And you're still in therapy?
Not really. I just go to see my doctor to keep my...
The medication?
Yeah.
Okay. And what about support groups? Do you think that support groups are a viable option?
Yeah, I think they're really good in the beginning until you really feel secure about it. It really helps to have other people who've gone through the same thing. Like when I was young, there was a 60-year-old lady in my support group and another lady my age and a couple of men. And it's really interesting to hear their stories, which can be quite different, you know, but they're all taking medicine and doing the same thing and they're going through the same thing you are, but maybe in different ways. In other words, it manifests differently in different personalities. So it gave me a little hope that this old lady was dealing with it well. You know, the support group, I think, is vital in the beginning. I had 8 years of real going twice a week to therapy,
okay,
to a support group. And it's funny because my dad said once, he said this, you know, my 3 older brothers, he said, Ann, he didn't say this to be mean or anything. He just said, And, you know, I spent more on you than all three boys combined.
And
I
you
didn't know
said,
what to say.
You
hey,
should
Dad, look how great I turned out.
You should have said, isn't that what everyone does for a little princess?
Yeah.
I have to thank you so much for joining us today. You really have, I think, have given the listeners a real look inside of your experience and your life as you have dealt with bipolar disorder, gotten treatment, stayed in treatment, and lived your life and done quite well.
Yes, and I want to say that hope is there for everybody.
And that is so important, and I thank you for that. And on that note, I will say thank you to the listeners for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Andy, you have a website?
Yes, I'm on Facebook. It's the name of the book, How to Enjoy Life with Bipolar Disorder. It's on Facebook. And I'm doing Twitter and blog.
Wonderful. Okay. And again, folks, that is Ann, A-N-N, Latta, L-A-T-T-A, Donnan, D-O-N-N-A-N. Thank you again, Ann. And thank you, folks, for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to take the place of any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications produce the program. If you would like to be in touch with me, if you would like to be in touch with me, you can do so via email, pamela@mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And folks, you should remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.